Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. 40 years ago, Sylvia Plath wrote that the surgeon is quiet. He does not speak. He has seen too much death. His hands are full of it. On the other hand, every doctor is obliged to adhere to an oath that says, I will remember that there is art to medicine as well as science, and that warmth, sympathy, and understanding may outweigh the surgeon's knife or the chemist's drug. Well, we have two doctors with us in the studio this hour. Dr. Zev Wiener works in Tel Aviv. Dr. Jumana Odeh works in Ramallah. Dr. Wiener is an Israeli specializing in psychiatry and psychotherapy. Dr. Odeh is a pediatrician who runs the Palestinian Happy Child Center. Well, they are also both teachers in areas of medical ethics and stress, and they are both key figures with Physicians for Human Rights in their respective areas, and they're here to talk about the Arab-Israeli conflict as they see it. We'd like to have you join us this hour. Is there any new way of looking at this conflict that can change what seems to be a complete standoff? Is it only up to the politicians, the militants, or the soldiers? Or is there still space for the citizens' voice? Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Dr. Jumana Odeh and Dr. Zev Wiener, it's nice of you both to join us in the studio.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Now, you choose to or have decided to appear together for a very clear reason. What would that be?
Actually, we've been working together previously, too. I mean, with Physicians for Human Rights Palestinian chapter and Israeli chapter. Besides that, we are physicians, and we have the same patients sometimes. So we share patients, we share pain, we share cure.
And we share the profession, and the ethical basis of this profession.
Tell me, could you do a radio program like this in Israel? Based out of Tel Aviv or Jerusalem? Does this go on? I don't know.
I think that it will go on certain times. Sometimes when terror rises up, so you can't find a place for such people as we are. But I think in general, it could be raised.
It never happened, but there's a space for it.
I just wonder whether or not, given the depth of anger that we have heard on this program and from people living in the area as well as people living in this country, whether or not there isn't a growing group of people saying, you know, Zev, forget it. It's just not going to make any difference. We've had politicians working at this. We've had presidents and prime ministers, and we've had religious leaders. And look where we are. We're no further ahead than we were 4 years ago or even before that. What do you say?
You're right. This might be the general mood, according to the achievements of the politicians, but this is the proof that we, people like us, have a different position and different point of view, and we should strive in order to achieve our place in that discourse because the political discourse failed.
For me, I could feel from my practice with women and parents of my patients and even with my students at the medical school and school of public health that people are fed up and they really want a solution and they don't want to depend only on politicians. And from my point of view, I believe even while politicians try to find out or they fail or they succeed, meanwhile, we have to do our duty as physicians, as parents, as mother, me as a mother, I believe I have lots of duties to do with my patients, with my students, with the mothers of my patients, and it's a lot to do, to talk to them, to see how do they feel about the whole thing, and sometimes it's indirect affected, I mean, the occupation is indirectly affecting people or directly affecting people, but there are some other problems that has nothing to do with the occupation. Our internal issues that we have to raise up and talk to people about it. And I feel that people in general are more optimistic than the politicians, especially if
optimistic.
Yes, and much more than politicians, especially if they switch off and they don't want to see the media, to follow the media, radios or TVs, mainly TVs in our country people prefer to watch.
We also have a mission to protect our profession. Our profession is at stake in times of conflict. The basics of the Hippocratic Oath are under threat because of the military conflicts. And we have got to raise our voice in order to bring forth the basis of human rights, of medicine, of health care, of alleviating pain and sorrow to people, whoever they are.
Okay, let's talk about some specifics here. And you gave me some numbers in advance of this, Zev, or I was looking at it in one of your papers. 274 security forces killed in the last 4 years, 1,777 injured, 635 civilians killed, 4,300 injured. That's on the Israeli side, if I've got my numbers
the correct. The numbers are higher. Since the time I gave you this report up to now, it's more than 900 people, Israeli people killed, and more than a few thousands, more than 6,000 are injured.
Now, some of these people who you deal with professionally and people who you teach will have had a son or a daughter killed or injured. I mean, the numbers are now such that nobody, as I understand it, remains untouched by this level of violence. Is that a reasonable way of putting it?
It's very reasonable because the impact of the military conflict is not only individual impact, but it has impact on the society.
Okay, well, let's just keep it individual for the time being. If somebody's going to say to you, what are you doing, you know, trying to work with these same people who are strapping bombs around their belts and climbing on the buses? Give it up, Zev. It's just not worth it.
If I give it up, I give my humanistic existence up, I give my profession up, I give my state and identity up, and I don't want to give up. I want to live in a peaceful, secular, democratic state, and therefore I'll strive in order to let my voice be heard to many other people. Those who want to join me, and there are many who want to join me, they will join, and step by step we'll build a civil society that her voice will have an impact on politicians.
But are there also voices that sound more like mine? That say, don't bother with this.
Extremism prevails when terror and conflict and military occupation keeps on. And we have to fight fundamentalism, because fundamentalism is bad for both sides, for the occupier and for the victim. Terrorism is bad for bad sides, for both sides. Mm-hmm. So the fact that we are physicians and we want to raise the voice of human rights, of the humanistic point of view, is kind of a common denominator that can engage many people to fight and give their place in the discourse and the political discourse that failed.
Okay, but Jemana, in practical terms, how hard is it to do that? Your own daughter at one point said to you, Mom, why are you doing this? What? You know?
Yeah, when her cousin was killed by Israeli soldier, and at the same time, a few days later, I rescued the life of an Israeli woman in the street, and I will do that even if I rescue a life of a soldier. I don't mind. I mean, this is my duty, and I have to do it no matter what. But it was really very, very difficult for me to explain to my daughter that, and it took her a while to understand, and she was cross with me for more than 2 months. She didn't want to talk to me, and I really faced this problem. Moreover, that our house was attacked several times in Ramallah by settlers, and we were under shelling for more than 3 hours once, and I was all the way trying to protect my daughter. And next day she was telling me, and tomorrow you are talking to your friend Ora, or you go to Israeli hospitals, or you talk. And it is a dilemma somehow, but because I believe in that, I'm myself, and I try to explain to her as much as possible, even to my students. I do, I believe I have this mission, I'll continue, I'll never ever give up. And my daughters are more now understandable of what I'm doing, even they appreciate my role.
Okay, but your house is under mortar fire, and you're telling me that your own confidence is not shaken at that point?
It was, definitely. Of course, you know, I was thinking my daughter will be killed. I'll be killed, maybe. And even I was, next day, my daughter went to school. I couldn't believe how come she could cope and go to school. But that was for a short period of time. And to understand the confidence, conflict, it's not easy sometimes. It's so complicated. But I try to explain to my daughter that these are settlers. It doesn't mean that all Israelis are settlers. You have our friends in elsewhere in West Jerusalem or Tel Aviv or Haifa, and we deal with them as human beings. We are friends, and we can eat together, go out together. It took a while. It's a long, ongoing struggle and ongoing process. And it's not easy sometimes to explain to people what I'm doing. But if I keep thinking I'm a mother, I'm a physician, it's my duty. So, again, it is a mission that I'll give my life to.
One should not take it into extreme. Of course, it's difficult as a physician to sit in front of a mother that lost her two children in a suicide bombing. But
you've done this.
Well, this happened.
I've done that, actually. I've done that with our mothers who lost their kids. And I was really sorry to disturb
you.
No,
it's just, it's the personal understanding that's going to get me to really to a clearer understanding myself.
I've done that, and I was really amazed with the coping mechanism. At the beginning, there's anger, revenge, and hatred. And by time, people believe that we sacrificed our kids for a cause, but it is about time. Not everybody, very few from both sides, I believe, but it's about time to stop this killing. We are fed up from the bloodshed. But when I did it, it was extremely difficult.
So you've got to find the right place and the right time and the right people to talk to, and not just to impose yourself with your ideas on people that are full of sorrow and pain and grieving. On the other hand, you can find people that lost their beloved in the terrorist attacks, and they still strive for connections with Palestinians, Palestinians' mothers and fathers, those who lost both sides, their beloved. So there is a hope, and people understand that in spite, or maybe because of the sorrow and the unbearable pain, another way should be sought.
And when the two of you travel together or have an opportunity to compare notes, are you in any way struck by how similar the work that you're doing is? I'm not searching for some kind of equivalency here, but I'm just wondering, when you say this is, you know, Jemani, you say this is what I was dealing with last week, and you and Zev, the same thing. Are you at any time ever struck by how much difficulty you're having on both sides here?
Yeah, actually, we feel that we both, as physicians, we share lots of things together, and at least our profession and our feelings. And we feel sometimes it's a dilemma for both of us that to explain to our people that what's going on, it's not the proper way of doing it, and it's about time to live together and try to. It's not easy for a person who lost someone. Mm-hmm. But would you share this information and this feelings, actually? And we found, I didn't know Zeva well. I know a physician for human rights, but Israel, and we worked together. But we met before briefly once in a conference, and this was the first time for me to be close and talk about it. And sometimes we disagree, and sometimes we agree. Not necessarily that we...
I was spending a very intensive 5 days with Jumana traveling, and so far we didn't have the chance to quarrel. Mm-hmm. It doesn't say that we do not differ in our visions, in our view. We are different people. We are different professions. I mean, medical profession, but different. Mm-hmm. And, of course, with different interests. But we manage not to quarrel and to find the common denominators between us in order to keep on this discourse going on.
Wouldn't it be interesting if the people who were in charge of making the decisions could do exactly the same sort of thing? But so far that's not the case, and it's in part why. Jemana and Zev are with me this hour and taking your calls. We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. With me in the studio this hour, Dr. Jemana Odeh. She is a pediatrician. She lives in Jerusalem, works in Ramallah. She's a founding member of Physicians for Human Rights Palestine and director of the Palestinian Happy Child Center in Ramallah, which treats children with special needs such as epilepsy. Dr. Zev Wiener is also with me. He's a family physician, a psychiatrist and psychotherapist. He's based in Tel Aviv, a longtime volunteer with Physicians for Human Rights Israel, and has been involved in offering medical aid to Palestinians in the occupied territories as well. I want to just step away, I guess, Zev, from the the numbers that we were talking about earlier, how many people have been killed, how many people have been injured, because I think probably to better understand the type of work that you both do is to get a clearer understanding of how everybody ends up being affected psychologically by life in a town or a city where who knows whether or not a bomb is going to blow up in a bus or you're going to be stopped by something. Have you come to any new conclusions about the way that people are being affected psychologically?
I'm sad to say, but we have a very, very vast experience about the psychological impact of suicide bombing on civilians. We know that at the beginning there are lots of psychological reactions like anxiety, depression, cognitive disarray. But most of the people will cope after 2 or 3 weeks and maybe months. But there are people that will develop psychiatric disorders that will be long-standing and very, very disabling, such as post-traumatic stress disorder, in which the visions of the suicide attack comes back and back and back for months, for years, and of course it's understandable that in this condition they cannot function, not in their family, not in their work and so. And of course it's difficult. You get up in a nice, shiny Tel Aviv morning, you want to go to work, you send your children to school, and you really, in the back of your mind, are not sure that you're going to come back. Because who knows if today or tomorrow there'll be another suicide bomb in a bus or in a cafe that you want to go. So it's in the back of the mind of most of the Israelis. So you can define it professionally as depression or a chronic anxiety. But mainly, if I'm talking non-professional, I would say it's in the back of the mind of most of the Israelis, not knowing if you get up in the morning, how will you go back home at the evening?
Jemena, the same thing
similar.
Yeah,
of course. You know, my kids go to school. I don't know if they can come back or not. My patients, it takes them, instead of 1 hour, 4 or 5 hours to reach me to be treated.
That's because they have to cross a checkpoint?
Because, yes, several checkpoints, and it might be shot at, and they might be killed, they might be injured. They live under uncertainty. When can they go back home or not? I have 2 weeks ago, I got a child coming to me. He was stopped by soldiers with his parents at the checkpoint, and he was fitting. He has epilepsy, and he was
having fits
on the checkpoint for more than half an hour, and the soldiers didn't allow him to enter. So I had to go to the checkpoint and give help to that child, and after that I talked to the officer in order to bring him to Ramallah, and I succeeded. But these stories are happening on daily life in Palestinian areas, in the West Bank, Gaza, and all over. You know, occupation have affected harshly the population for the last 35 years. And we deal with the children with anger, with traumatized children, with parents, but mainly children. This is what I do. And always it's not easy to treat. But I share with Zev that the signs and symptoms are almost similar from professional point of view, and hopefully enough that kids can overcome it and cope with all these traumatizing events.
1-800-423-8255. Let's take our first call from Newton, Massachusetts. Peter is joining us on the phone. Peter, thanks for calling.
Yes, hi. I think that in talking with friends, there's talk about the number of killed, and in terms of wounded, it's not really a real number. I think people view them as these are people who go home with like stitches or cuts, bruises. I wonder if there would be a comment about the wounded, about the severity, that versus the death that they have and what they've seen and the response when they speak to other people about the wounded. Do people understand what wounded means?
Yeah, I think it's a good question because we deal in those numbers of people killed as if it is some kind of, you know, mark. There were 14
figures
killed on a raid in Gaza this weekend, and it's the number 14 that mm-hmm. you use to measure the severity
yes.
of it. But mm-hmm. but then the number of those injured, for example, as Peter's saying, mm-hmm. Is never much a part of that. But a lot of those people would be the people that you're both dealing with. Is that right, Joanna?
Yes, that's right. And actually, it's not only the scars, the physical scars. What about the psychological scars that nobody could tell? Nobody can judge what would happen to those people deep inside after any of this traumatic event. And there are lots of disabled people becoming in the Palestinian community out of, the occupation and all these attacks. And unfortunately, it's a burden for physicians and for the society at large to deal with them. Yes, we do have a real problem about
this is where I get a little bit caught in something that you said earlier about there being a sense of optimism, because neither of you are telling me anything that is particularly optimistic.
Aren't we that sitting in front of you both together and agreeing, isn't that optimistic? A bit? Something. This is the message we want to convey. And Peter was right. Numbers cause depersonalization. Numbers detach us from the human being, from sorrow and pain. Of course, he's right. There are many wounded people amongst us, physically and mentally. And we are trying to help them on a daily basis. But in spite of these wounds, and in order to cure and to prevent further wounds, we have to keep on what we are doing professionally and from human rights perspective.
About optimism, actually, I believe that this is what I got from the feeling of my parents and patients, that we are fed up. We've reached the edge. We can't go on with this traumatic events. So somebody should shout out that stop it, and we have to deal with ourselves otherwise. We have to know the other. And this is what I believe is something optimistic coming out of people, not of politicians or media or propaganda. It is real. Yes, it's minimal, but it's there.
Okay, 1-800-423-8255. Let's take another call. This one from Lexington, Massachusetts, and it's Gray on the phone. Gray, thank you for calling.
Yeah, hi. In terms of the cycle of revenge, I'm interested if the doctors see any differences in terms of the coping between the parents, between the males and the females, whether or not they see a response to the tragedy or the coping or anything like that.
You mean in the people that they talk to who are dealing with the violence?
Parents.
Right, either parents or
parents.
Relatives or...
Okay.
Yes. From my side, I noticed that if mothers have dual trauma or to deal with because of several reasons, actually. So mothers or females are more traumatized or more involved in that more than males, mainly because many mothers are not working in our society, so they have to deal with children on a daily basis, and fathers are working outside. But my impression, I don't have statistics, but my impression is that mothers are more affected than fathers.
The closer you are to a traumatic event, so the worse are the consequences. So, of course, if you meet a mother or a father that lost two children and his wife or husband, you'll find them in much worse situation than the others. Maybe I can sit here and speak so nicely because, God forbid, I wasn't inflicted. I didn't lose anyone of my close family yet. But in general, if you look at the psychiatric literature, not only on post-traumatic stress disorder or stress reactions, you will find, and it's difficult to understand, that women are developing more psychological reactions. Now, I won't imply that women are more problematic psychologically, but they are more expressive. They are more emotional. They tell their doctors more easily about their feelings than men. This is kind of a common knowledge in a society. So it might be biased to say that women are more vulnerable than men, but they are expressing their feelings and emotions and pain much more easily. But of course, we know there are subpopulations that are at risk, and children are at risk more than adults.
What do you mean children are at risk more in terms of the psychological effects
right.
of that?
Right, yes. Right.
Mm-hmm. They are more vulnerable, actually.
The prevalence of traumatic responses amongst children is much higher than amongst the adults.
See, I have a layman's understanding of this, and I would have thought that the children would also be more likely to bounce back.
That's
yes.
right.
Less
so,
likely. That's right.
So the prognosis after months, years, is better.
Right.
But when you look at them right after the event,
right after,
immediately,
yeah.
or weeks or months after the event, you will find a much higher prevalence of traumatic responses. But as time goes by, they have a very good coping skill to recuperate and go back to their previous function.
Traumatic mm-hmm. responses, you mean what? Not speaking or what?
Yes.
Traumatic
yes.
responses, mostly
crying,
psychological, is crying, is bedwetting, is depression, is anxiety, is school problem, learning problems, and many others.
We have one child that his house was shelled and he stopped talking for 3 days. And our psychologist counselors worked hard with him and with the family. Hopefully enough, after 3 days, he spoke out, and then we visited him later on, and his psyche or the psychological health is he's healthy and he goes to school normally. But each time there is any other event in the street, he's afraid and he goes immediately home. So this, we keep seeing these cases, yet we are happy that they can cope. They have their own mechanisms that they can cope, but nobody could tell what are the scars in the future. In 10 years, 5 years, I don't know. Nobody, we have no...
These are going to be the people who either will
yes.
or won't be sitting as you
yes,
are now.
Yes,
or
yes.
are
so
going
nobody,
to be the politicians, and
yeah.
it will be much worse. Because if they are post-traumatic and they become politicians and influential, so this vicious circle will keep on going.
You know, that's twice now, Zev, you've talked about people suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder, but
it's
in
still,
one twisted way, there's no post
yes,
here.
Yes, it's still there.
At all, because
trauma
it never...
Still there. Continuous trauma, yeah.
You're definitely right, because we are dealing... post-traumatic stress disorder is a professional term used in psychiatry, referring to a specific event, such as September 11, there was a horrible event, and then reactions. But we are dealing, in our area, both sides, with chronic traumatizations, with an ongoing threat that is still existing, and of course the reactions are quite different and much worse.
No post to it at all, Jumana. It's all sort of what's next, right?
Yeah, so it's not post, it's continuous trauma. Again, what we feel and what we see, that our kids are still coping, especially if they go to school, if the school environment is giving them support and
right.
it's a warm environment, especially if they come from an extended family and the majority are, and they have their grandparents, they have parents, their parents around, they have their brothers and sisters, they feel again that they are protected somehow. And this is, it's a very positive issue in our area.
1-800-423-8255. That's the number to join my conversation with these two doctors this hour. Next to Boston, Jay's on the line. Jay, thanks for calling.
Thank you. I have a question for the Palestinian doctor. And I was wondering if she'd ever treated any of the suicide bombers and for depression or for anything.
You mean the would-be suicide bomber, someone who is a suicide bomber is dead.
Actually, I have a story about one of my patients. I still remember his eyes, his heart beat. He was 4 years old when I became to be his pediatrician. And when he was 22, he committed suicide. He became a suicide bomber and he passed away, of course. And I could understand somehow why he did it, but it's beyond my feeling or beyond my thinking to accept it. And I feel he was a victim. He was used by some political groups, because who's giving them the bombs? And
did you think that you failed in that case, Jumana,
yes,
if you were treating this person?
Yes, and I felt so sad because he didn't have a serious disease, actually, and I was his pediatrician. He was a very smart guy. He was a student at the university, and I was really shocked when I heard that he committed suicide bombing. And so I believe he's a victim of one political group from Palestinian side and Sharon's policy and Israeli occupation. He's in between, and we lost this guy. So I understand them, but I don't accept what they do.
It is important to remark that both of us are treating people from both sides. I'm treating people, Arab people, citizens of Israel, of Tel Aviv, the Jaffa district.
Right.
And they are also inflicted by suicide bombing. And they develop also. People are people. They develop
in
also.
In what way? Because we see this in such black and white terms, Ev, that the victims, the people who suffer the trauma of suicide bombs are the Israelis. So in what way, when you're dealing with it is also fear of the same bombs, or it is fear of those bombs coming from their community and therefore the people where they live will be targeted?
When you come to your personal life, it's not fear of politics, of global politics. You want to live. People want to live, no matter if they're Arabs, Palestinians, Israelis, Jews, or whatever. And an Arab Israeli wants to live, and wants to live good. So it's not the political question that bothers Arabs in Israel. It's like my concerns. I want to go to work, to build a family, and to go home safely. And the suicide bombers do not discriminate Arab Israelis and Jewish Israelis. They are both inflicted, and we, doctors, should treat them the same.
Of course, we treat them the same, but suicide bombing means that they gun, so they are not treated. See, but as I said, I feel sad for that, and I can't accept it. I can't accept that our children become bombs.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. My two guests with me in the Connection studio this hour, Dr. Zev Wiener, family physician, psychiatrist, psychotherapist based in Tel Aviv. Dr. Jumana Odeh is a pediatrician based in Jerusalem. She is a director of the Palestinian Happy Child Center in Ramallah, where she treats children with special needs such as epilepsy. They are both in the business of teaching medical ethics. We'll talk a little bit more about that when we come back after the break. We'd also like to have you join our conversation. They have decided to travel, both in representing their respective organizations, the Physicians for Human Rights, to say that it isn't necessarily as miserable and as hopeless a situation as we are led to believe by looking at the front page of the newspaper. And we'd like to have you join our conversation. 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Once again, our number 1-800-423-TALK. We're going to go straight back to the lines to Wayland, Massachusetts, and Julie is with us. Julie, thanks for calling.
Oh, thank you for hearing my question. I have actually one comment and one question. First, I've just recently returned from Israel. I returned on the 24th of February.
Do you live there, Julie, or were you just visiting?
I was on a spiritual mission, but we were also visiting families that our synagogue has adopted in terms of providing support for those who have been victimized by terrorist attacks.
Right.
And we did visit with several different families that had been wounded in the attacks. And so just to reiterate on your earlier comment about the number wounded, I don't think we do appreciate or understand the ripple effect and how many people are affected by the wounded, and it's their families, and it's the economy, and I mean, it just goes on and on and on, the degree of impact of the wounded. I think that was an important point.
Okay.
But my question is, one of the things that really struck me when we were there is that during the morning of the explosion of bus number 14, it happened at about 8:30 during rush hour, and we were staying at the Dan Pearl in Jerusalem, and some of the people in our hotel could hear the blast. And when we drove by just a few hours later, it was all cleaned up. Everything was gone. It was like nothing had happened. people were back on the streets walking around and doing their shopping. Sunday is a regular business day in Israel.
Yeah.
And I wanted to ask the doctors whether or not they thought this was the best way to deal with this kind of violence, and how does that either help or hinder people in terms of coping with the stress and the trauma.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we had no opportunity, you know, among our group to really talk about what had happened. We just sort of went on with our day, and I found that very, very strange. And I would just like to hear what they have to say.
That's a great question, Julie, because if I'm not mistaken, Zev, it is a mark of pride for the Israelis to make sure that whatever kind of bomb blast happens is in fact cleaned up as fast as possible. Life returns to normal, whether it's cafe, bus. Is that right?
I'm a part of a system that takes care of the victims, and as soon as a suicide bomb occurs, we are on the scene, and then we are escorting, giving psychological first aid, and then escorting victims to the morgue or to the hospitals. Anyway, you are right, Julie. 2-3 hours after the event, everything is cleaned, and you see the cafes in Tel Aviv, they are full, mainly. And there are a couple of researchers showing that visiting movies and cafes in general did not decrease. So on one hand, I should be proud because we co-op. And it's not a question of if it's good or bad. This is a natural reaction of the public. But I'm not only proud, because this is a coping mechanism and coping skill, otherwise we wouldn't survive. On the other hand, I am a bit worried, because this is a dissociative phenomenon. We are dissociating ourselves from events that should inflict the whole society. We are dissociating ourselves from pain and sorrow of individuals that are part of our community. And on the long run, it can inflict the whole infrastructure of the Israeli community.
And if I look at it on the flip side, from my understanding of what happens when someone in the Gaza or area, for example, is killed, that the cleanup does not happen as quickly, and then there is invariably a fairly large rally after that, either to mark the death, to give people a chance to... it's not a celebration, but mm-hmm. but you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
Just
yeah.
to gather together. That's something that's different, is it not,
yeah.
Benjamin?
Yeah, actually, I do agree that everything should be cleaned up, and that life goes on, no matter what. With all pain, it goes on. I disagree somehow with our media when they continue. Not somehow. I disagree totally that the blood or these events supposed to be repeatedly put in the media, and especially in the TVs, because it is traumatizing too. It doesn't mean that people will forget what happened, but they have to deal with it and try to cope. I know. I understand how painful and how sad is that, and I'm not comparing because loss is loss. If I'm an Israeli mother or Palestinian mother, I lose my son or daughter. For me, it's the same. Tears are of all mothers are equally salty. It's supposed to be cleaned immediately, and people has to try to understand why this is happening and to try to prevent from both sides that it's not normal to kill. It's not normal to see. It's not the norms of life to see only blood and bloodshed. And I believe both nations deserve to live better life, and both nations are fed up from the bloodshed.
I mentioned just before we went to the break that you are both in the business of lecturing in matters of medical ethics. And Zev, maybe I can start with you here. I'm fascinated to know what it is your students bring to you as a professor, what kind of questions you have, whether or not in your students and in their questions you have seen a change in the understanding or challenging some of the very basic tenets of the Hippocratic Oath, like, Professor, why should we... minister to both sides when we look at the level of violence. What? Take me inside a classroom for what's going on.
You know,
there.
Dick, I'll take you inside the classroom, and if there'll be questions, I'll be happy. I am on the stage of bringing those questions to the awareness of the students, because as the last audience, Julie asked about the dissociations
yeah.
that you're talking, Medical students and the medical professions mostly are also dissociated from the problem, from the sorrow. They say, well, we treat, we go to our job, we treat people, we operate on them, and that is it.
Right.
And the first step is to raise the question, to tell them, hey, there is a problem. You work automatically in the emergency room. You work automatically in the territories. You work wherever you work, but there is a problem. There is a problem of differentiating between Arabs and Jews. It is a problem that you become suspicious about your patient. If your patient is an Arabic and you have to treat him, so you think automatically, is he a suicide bomber or maybe his son will be? How this inflicts your profession, your morals. People do not understand that this is an ongoing process that endangers the moral and the basic ethical concepts of our profession.
But how do you shake them out of that?
We raise the question. We confront them. What do you do if you are in an emergency room and people come, Arabs and Jews? How do you choose? Is it only medical basis? Is it evidence-based medicine? Or you look if he's an Arabic or is he a Jew? And according to that, you prescribe the medications. Or if you have to go in your army services to treat people in the occupied territories, do you treat settlers the same as Palestinian civilians that were injured? And this conflict imposes new questions to medical profession. How do doctors can operate medically in conflictual situation?
I face that in my teaching at the medical school, medical ethics, and I try to challenge I try to challenge them and I ask them, if you have an Israeli soldier injured, would you treat or not? And one of the students, a female student, started shouting and screaming and crying. Apparently, her brother was killed by Israeli soldiers, so it wasn't at ease. She wasn't at ease and it wasn't at all easy for her. She was second year student and now she's this sixth. Last year she was 6 year, and hopefully enough that she changed a bit, but for her it was really painful to agree that yes, I'll do it. Israeli person, no problem, but Israeli soldier, it was a difficult issue for her. But by time, as a medical student and she's becoming a doctor soon, she changed a bit. But
does
it's not easy.
Does this trouble you? That people, well, I mean, we're talking about very natural, normal human reactions.
Yes,
here.
Yes.
I
respected her reaction, of course. If I was in her place, maybe I'll do the same. I don't know, actually.
Okay, but would you fail her in the medical ethics course? Would you say
this
girl's not ready to be a doctor?
No, not at all. I tried to help her more, and I tried to explain to her why, and it took her 4 years, 4 or 5 years to accept it as a concept. You know, it's not easy. We are human beings. And yes, I do agree that Hippocratic oath is the bottom line for our profession. Yet we are human beings.
Medical ethics is not there to accept human reaction. Medical ethics is like anatomy, like physiology. It is to modify the doctor's reaction according to the basics of his profession. So I do accept and listen to my students' reactions, but I do try to influence and modify them according to my belief and to my professions.
I'm interested in hearing from both of you why you think it's important to travel outside your country, to go to Europe, to come to the United States, to participate in programs like this. I could say that the problems exist between Israelis and Palestinians, you know, physician, heal thyself. Go fix that problem. Don't bring it here to. But you've made a decision to come here. Why is that?
Because I do believe that even if the politicians have failed, we shouldn't give up. We physicians, we civilians, civil society people, supposed to continue working for the good of both nations. And I would the main issue actually for me, and really this is my dream and hope, that one day Israeli kids will go to their school safe and won't be afraid of any bombing or any attack. At the same time, I would dream of Palestinian children going to their schools with no checkpoints, with no Israeli soldiers stopping them or killing or so on. And I have a deep faith on that, that the new generation will live better life than this one. And what the politicians failed in, the social civil society could achieve. I do believe in that.
We need third party to set the stage in order us to conversate. And I think that in this case, PHR USA was setting the stage for us to meet, to talk, and publish our concepts. But more than that, conflicts are all over the world. Conflicts are in Europe, in the States, in Asia, in Africa. And I think the whole world is a global village, can learn how to deal with conflicts from our said experience.
Okay, now, I mean, President Bush and Colin Powell don't often listen right through to the hour that we put on the radio here, but you're not speaking to the politicians, are you? You're trying to use the radio and other forms of media in the United States and in Europe to reach ordinary people, people who have been following this conflict along with
interest. I was speaking
and confusion.
To your callers, and people to the callers.
And so what are you saying to them? Well, what can they do? You know, this President Bush can't get along with Yasser Arafat, who can't get along with Ariel Sharon, full stop. The thing's over. No?
But I wish that politicians will listen to us, including President Bush, and see us as human, both sides. He should see us Palestinians and human as human beings.
I don't think that each American can do specific things in order to solve the Middle East conflict. I'm not sure that he has to. But first of all, to change the concept, to change the state of mind, it implies also to our domestic problem.
So you plant one new idea today. What is it, the idea that you want to plant in somebody's mind, Zev?
That even conflicts are all over, you can find common grounds in order to communicate and bridge gaps. And our mission is to find those common grounds. We found medical ethics, medical profession as a common ground. Each one of you can find another common ground, but not to enhance the conflict, but to bridge the gap.
And I believe that it's about time for both nations to feel not only the pain of each other and the joy of each other. Actually, we deserve both nations to live in peace and dignity. And this is my message to politicians and anybody else, I mean, here in the United States and in Europe.
Thank you both for coming in. I wish you both luck.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thanks. For having us.
Dr. Zev Wieners, a family physician, psychiatrist, and psychotherapist based in Tel Aviv. Dr. Jumana Odeh is a pediatrician based in Ramallah and Jerusalem. Both are affiliated with Physicians for Human Rights in their respective areas. The Connection is produced by Nancy Cohen, Catherine Fenollosa, Sarah Field, Kelly Jones, Jen Mattson, Christina Russo, and Doug Sugarts. Tara Murphy is our senior producer. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.